Good morning and welcome to the Beacon. Good morning, I'm Bill Jurek. Thanks for joining us. Lainey's on vacation this week. She's out of town enjoying California. But we have a very special treat for you today. It's one of our profile programs. We'll be featuring Mr. Jim Kesteluth, the former chief executive officer at the Chicago Lighthouse and president, now a board member there and also a board member of the American Foundation for the Blind, as well as sitting on a very special Ability One committee in Washington, D.C. We'll get our interview with Mr. Kesteluth underway right after this.
Every day, PACE is helping more and more people with disabilities take control of their day.
My friends change plans a lot, which was tough because my rides had to be booked a day before. One day, I figured out how easy it was to put my wheelchair onto regular PACE buses. Since then, I haven't missed out on any pickup games. Yesterday, I had 10 rebounds.
Freedom means being able to go wherever I want, when I want. Before, things like missing an ingredient for a recipe or other unexpected errands were a real pain to figure out. Once I learned my service dog Nola was welcome aboard PACE Fix routes, we've been riding ever since.
Hi, I'm Bridget Brown. If you're anything like me, it drives you nuts when you feel like you're missing out on things. Now I make plans in the middle of the day without even thinking twice about it, thanks to the PACE Bus.
When you're ready to take control of your day, visit PACEBus.com or call 847-364-PACE. PACE. Connecting communities.
Coming to the end of summer, and we thought it would be an appropriate time to do another one of our profile shows here on the Beacon. And let's see, in the past, we've talked to Steve and Georgiana Pangier. We talked about retired Cook County Circuit Court Judge Nick Pomero and about his career. And we are going a little bit closer to home now, being that the Beacon program is underwritten by the Chicago Lighthouse and Friedman Place. And when I say closer to home, I'm talking about the Chicago Lighthouse, because a gentleman who was a fixture for the Lighthouse in many years, someone who was recognized as being a leader, a innovator at the Lighthouse, was a gentleman by the name of Jim Kesteluth. And we want to welcome to the program this morning. Jim is the former executive director of the Lighthouse, currently is a member of the U.S. Ability One Commission, and sits on the Lighthouse board as well as the board for the American Foundation for the Blind. Jim, welcome. It's nice to have you on the program.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
You know, you and I have talked off the air a lot about similarities that we have in common, the fact that we both came from the same Northwest Side neighborhood in Chicago. And when we compared notes, we found out we had a lot in common. And it was Jim's efforts that actually saved Chris Radio, which is the Chicago Radio and Information Service, one that I've talked about on this Beacon program for quite a few months, quite a few years now, as a matter of fact, when I think about it, because the show's 5 years old. And we talk about it and how we like to invite people to come in and be volunteer readers for us. We had a chance of going under, and it was through Jim's foresight that we were able to become one of the 28 programs that are offered by the Chicago Lighthouse, and we're very grateful for that fact. But you've got a story all unto yourself, because you've done a lot of different things, and you did them at a time when, well, people were not expecting a lot of someone who had a disability, whether it was a outward disability, an inward disability. In your case, it was vision, just like it was mine. How did this all get started? When did you first discover, your family discover that you had a vision problem?
Well, that's an interesting question. I remember as a small child being at Humboldt Park. And I'm talking about a small child. I maybe was 3 years old or so. And we were in the boathouse at Humboldt Park. I was with my brothers, and we were fishing for bullheads. And my brothers were looking over the edge of the pier in the boathouse and saying, you know, here, look at there's some bullheads here. Drop your line here. And I could hear the echoing, you know, of them saying where the fish were. But when I looked over the edge of the pier, I couldn't see anything.
Uh-huh.
And even at age 3, I realized I couldn't see. But I wasn't able at that age really to articulate it very well, if at all, mm-hmm. To my parents. And it was probably a year or two after that. I was probably in kindergarten, and we went to a picnic on a farm, and someone was sitting in a chair, and somebody said, go give your uncle a hug. It really wasn't my uncle. I don't know who it was.
Mm-hmm.
But, a 4 or 5-year-old ran up to him, and he had a cigar in his mouth, only I didn't see the cigar, and I caught that cigar in my eye.
Ooh.
But there wasn't any damage, from the cigar. Parents immediately took me to the emergency room and an ophthalmologist, and the ophthalmologist said he told my parents the reason I ran into that cigar was because I didn't see it.
Right.
The cigar burn really didn't do any permanent damage, but through that examination, it was discovered that I had cone rod dystrophy and was legally blind.
What is that? So people understand what that's about, cone and rod dystrophy.
Well, sometimes you hear this term macular degeneration, age-related macular degeneration. There is a juvenile form of macular degeneration, and you can break that down into several different types, and one type is cone rod dystrophy. The macula is the central part of your retina where images are focused. Usually has to do with seeing small things and seeing detail and color, that type of thing. You can see gross objects, larger objects, but generally with that kind of eye condition, the bigger the object is, the easier it is to see, and the closer the object is, the easier it is to see, the heavier the contrast, the easier it is to see. But with juvenile macular degeneration or age-related macular degeneration, something that happens to older people, age-related macular degeneration, usually the ability to read print fails because print is so small.
Right.
In the early days, when I was 4 or 5, I could move around, see tables and chairs and couches, but I couldn't see the small things. So it was difficult and is generally difficult for parents of small children to really pick it up until the child goes into kindergarten or first grade when they start having to, use their vision on detailed type things such as reading.
Right. So did you have, obviously you must have had when you did start school, some difficulty reading the regular texts that were in the primer books for reading and that sort of thing?
Yeah, in those days there was no technology.
No, absolutely.
So, when I look back at my first 8 years, my grammar school years, I never had a book I could read.
It was pretty tough because you had gone not to Chicago public schools, but you went to private school, right?
Right, various Catholic parochial schools, mm-hmm. but they made sure I got through. Great respect, for the parochial school system, mm-hmm. because at the time, such minimal resources, yet I was able to get through that. When I started high school, my brothers went to Lane Tech, so I wanted to go to Lane.
Right.
But when I got there, it's a massive school, 5,000 students at the time. Numbers were above the doors, couldn't read the numbers, couldn't find a classroom, had a locker, numbers were too high to read, couldn't find my locker, couldn't read the blackboard. There were no large print books or anything like that at the time. So it took about a month for them to figure out, I needed a special program, and I was referred to Schurz High School.
They did have a special program over there, right, at Schurz?
At Schurz, they had a program for students who were blind and visually impaired, and, that was 1958.
Mm-hmm.
So the Illinois Instructional Materials Center wasn't in existence at that time. That didn't come into existence in 1965, and that's a program that supplies mm-hmm. students in grade school and high school with large print books or braille books. So I went in 1958 to Schurz High School, and even then did not have any books I could read.
How did the instruction go then, since there wasn't that material there?
I'd take my books, throw it in a locker, close the locker, and then I would depend on listening in the classroom.
Right.
But it wasn't long. I was probably at, in September, I was at Lane by the 1st of October, I was at Schur's.
Right.
But then I got a call from a former teacher. My parents got a call from a former teacher at St. Priscilla.
Mm-hmm.
And the nun says, you know, you got to take Jim over to see this doctor, Dr. Lieberman and Dr. Kraft.
Mm-hmm. All right. Right.
And
that's something we both have in common, too, by the way, both of those ophthalmologists. Yeah, go ahead.
Dr. Lieberman was one of five ophthalmologists that the Chicago Chicago Ophthalmological Society appointed to help set up a low vision clinic,
mm-hmm.
The first in America. So he was involved in setting up a low vision clinic. So
did he work with Dr. Rosenblum on that?
Right.
Okay.
There were five ophthalmologists and five optometrists that were appointed. Five optometrists from Illinois Optometric Association, and Dr. Rosenblum was one that was appointed to help set up the clinic, along with four other optometrists and five ophthalmologists.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember my parents say we're going to go to the lighthouse. You know, we saw Dr. Lieberman and Kraft, and they said, you know, take Jim over to the lighthouse. They have a low vision clinic there. But I remember thinking, another doctor.
Yeah.
Parents take their kids everywhere, you know, to try to resolve that kind of problem.
Absolutely.
So when I was coming to the lighthouse, I thought to myself, yeah, right, another doctor. But I humored my parents
and
went. But I'll never forget sitting in the exam chair and a doctor, Dr. Rosenblum, putting a trial frame on my face with a low vision lens in it, a microscopic lens. Took a card, put it in my hand with various size print on it, took my hand and he pushed it up to the lens, about an inch away from the lens,
right.
A microscopic lens. And I was so stunned because I could see print.
Right.
I just...
First time ever, right?
First time ever. And I stood up out of the exam chair, you know?
Yeah.
And that was... So I was a freshman in high school.
Right, about 14.
14, yeah. And I could see the print. And with that lens, that was probably the most important thing that ever happened to me was getting a low vision exam, because I was able to read my way through high school slowly, very slowly, but comfortably, and, you know, through college, too.
Yeah. So you finished the 4 years at Schur's, and then you had to make a decision at that point what you wanted to do. What was one of your ambitions, and were you always set on getting involved in working with the visually impaired? I'll tell you what, hang on a second. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about, we'll get the story of how you, started down the path of your adulthood. We're talking to Jim Kestelute, who is the former executive director over at the Chicago Lighthouse and now sits on the U.S., make sure I get it right,
Ability One Commission,
and is also on the board of directors for the American Foundation of the Blind. We'll be back with more of Jim's story on our profile program right after this.
So, you know, I'm a dog, and I'm kind of new to this family, but I've noticed a trend. My humans do this thing where they go around and get all my toys and hide them in this basket, but it's always the same basket, and it's always the same place, and then they act so surprised when I find them, but I'm like, hello? That's where you put it last time. Humans are the worst at hide-and-go-seek.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
Thanks for joining us on this Saturday morning. We're glad that you could join us for breakfast and also to be part of one of our profile programs that we do here on the Beacon from time to time. Jim Kestelute is joining us, and a lot of people in the blind, the visually impaired community know that name just by mentioning it. They know who you are and what your background is, and Jim was the former executive director here at the Lighthouse and also has quite a few other important credentials. We've gotten to a point now in Jim's career and his life where he had graduated high school and you were about to set out on your path for adulthood. Did you have any idea what you wanted to do?
No, I didn't. But you know what? I was fortunate to have at Schur's a vision teacher there named Eugene Fahey. He was in charge of the program for students with visual impairments.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I didn't know what I wanted to do, I think he saw as his job to make sure that I started thinking about that, that his students started to think about that and started some planning in that regard. And he referred me over to Illinois Department of Rehabilitation Services.
Mm-hmm.
And they got me thinking more about going on to college and applied to Loyola and was accepted.
Jim,
and,
what was the whole attitude? It was a lot different back at the time you were starting to go into college than it is today about students with visual impairment and that. Did people still have that stereotype about what you could and what you couldn't do or what you should be able to do and what you shouldn't be able to do?
Oh, sure. You know, and in those days, there weren't any special services that existed with universities or colleges. So, you know, it was almost a hit and miss kind of thing. Loyola, I think, was way, way ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. There were a number of totally blind students going to Loyola, both in undergraduate and graduate programs in law school. Students were accepted there. So I think they were kind of a natural, but that was something I didn't know at the time.
Right.
So, you know, I got a call from them after I took the entrance exam. And somebody there was very perceptive because I didn't tell anybody that I had a visual impairment. But, you know, when I read, you know, my face is right on that paper.
And,
that low vision lens. So somebody noticed it, and I got a call after the, a phone call after the exam. And I was told, you know, my scores were good enough for liberal arts. And
sure.
asked me if I wanted to go to Loyola, and of course I said yes. And then State Department of Rehabilitation Services helped pick up some of the costs mm-hmm. of the tuition and books.
So you had taken a liberal arts course.
I had a,
Little did you know where it was going to take you after the fact, right?
Yeah, I got a bachelor's degree in social sciences.
So
just a general degree.
So you got out, now you walked out of the graduation ceremony at Loyola, and you're holding your degree in your hand, and it's a social sciences. And did you kind of look and say, okay, what do I do now?
Yeah, absolutely. Started looking for a job.
Yeah.
And one of the first places I went to was Loyola University's placement service.
Sure.
And started getting calls from them for interviews, you know. And then I set up this little office in my basement and made lots of calls and sent out lots of letters myself.
Sure.
And I graduated in January of 67, but I finished everything in the summer of 66.
Okay.
So at the end of August, I had all the credits I needed. I was really done with classroom work, so I started looking for a job. And, you know, wasn't having any luck.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things that happened was towards the end of September, I get a call from Loyola's placement service.
Mm-hmm.
There was a woman there named Rosemary Deegan who had cerebral palsy.
Okay.
And she ran the placement service. I don't know how she knew I had a visual impairment, but she knew.
Right.
She called and says, "You got a job yet?" And, and I says, "Well, no."
Yeah.
And she says, "Well, there's this job open with Cook County Employment Service, Cook County Welfare Rehabilitation Service, also known as Cook County Employment Service,"
right,
which later was merged into State Department of Labor,
right,
State Employment Service. And I said, "Well, I don't have a job." And she says, "Well, there's a job opening over there for a counselor, placement counselor." And I remember it was a Friday, and I said, "Okay, I'll go over there Monday morning." She says, "No, you won't. You're going to go there right now."
Yeah.
So I got there at like 4 o'clock and worried about, do I tell this person I'm visually impaired who's interviewing
sure.
me and things. But I got a clue when the person interviewing me said that he got his job through Rosemary Deegan.
Uh-huh.
So I got hired, and I went to work for Welfare Rehab Service, which had Cook County Employment Service. So
sure.
I started, and they had all kinds of training programs for people who had special problems,
right,
including people with disabilities and people being released from
prison and that sort of thing.
Back wards of hospitals,
sure,
mental hospitals. So there was kind of a trend at that time to deinstitutionalize people and they were referred into our program. We would do training, and I would look for jobs for them.
Right.
And one day this guy walks in and asks the director of the agency if he could have access to the county's job bank. He wanted to know the job openings. And the director of the agency brought him over to me, and he was the placement counselor from the Chicago Lighthouse.
Okay.
And he wanted to be able to call the State Employment Service and find out what job openings there were that he could refer people who are blind.
Blind vision.
He wanted a resource.
Yeah.
So the director connected him with me, so we got to be pretty good friends. I would, refer him job openings that came, mm-hmm. or if he called with somebody, I'd check, see what job openings there were, take the case, refer. And then he retired. When he retired, I applied for his job at the Chicago Lighthouse and was hired.
Lo and behold.
That was 1969. January of 1969.
So that's how it all began. When you started here at the Chicago Lighthouse.
Yes.
So you were actually in placement?
For 8 years.
For 8 years. Oh, my goodness. You've seen a lot of people come through. You've seen people who were clients. You've seen people who were proteges and professionals with you. In that department, you had a lot of exposure to a lot of different people. Did you see a commonality of people as far as their attitude when it came to working? Because I know one of your favorite lines, and I've quoted you many times on it, is that the one thing that a blind person wants more than anything else is a job. And we know that the unemployment rate for people who are blind, visually impaired, is well over 70%. Eagerness was always there, wasn't there? Or did you see some people who were extremely eager and some who were just there?
No, I think I like how you put it. I think if you ask any blind person what they want, they'll tell you they want a job. And, you know, as I talk about some of my own experiences, they're not unique. I consider everything I've said here to be common.
True.
A common experience. Experiences that most people who are blind have. But worrying about getting a job is one of them. And, mm-hmm. you know, the desire to work and to be independent and to do a job to an employer's satisfaction, to mm-hmm. sort of like an industrial and commercial standard, is really what people want. And that's one of the things I think I've always seen with people coming in into the Lighthouse. A lot of times, of course, you know, people are dealing with very traumatic life experience of mm-hmm. losing vision. So you have to maybe deal with some denial at first and some depression and
anger and that type of thing.
But by and large, if somebody walked through the door, they were coming, walked through the Lighthouse door. One of their goals, I think, in a common goal of everybody was really to take a look at an employment plan, a job plan.
Sure.
What do I need to do to get a job and mm-hmm. hold a job and be independent?
Was it easy to find positions at that time?
You know, that was when I started here in January of 69. That was before the Rehabilitation Act of 73.
And right.
The Rehab Act of 73 made it illegal to discriminate if you had a federal contract of $2,500 or more. It made it illegal to discriminate against a person with a disability. So when I started here in 69 and when I started with the Employment Service in 66, mm-hmm. you know, it was legal to give a physical and to say to somebody, I'm not going to hire you because you're
visually
have a disability,
impaired. Yeah,
you know?
Right.
So it was... it was more difficult because it was legitimate to deny somebody a job because of a disability. It's funny, a lot of times I hear people say, well, I don't know if the Americans with Disabilities Act has done much good. There's still lots of unemployment. But mm-hmm. if they don't have anything to compare it to, I've been around a long time, so I can compare it to when it was legal to discriminate.
Right.
And it was a huge change in 73. When that Rehab Act came into existence, because it required employers to have some kind of affirmative action plan, and mm-hmm. it was legitimate to talk to people and to consider someone with a disability for a job. So that made a huge difference. Prior to that, you know, I learned how to contact employers from working for the county employment service.
Right.
Calling, explaining your program, going to visit them, making referrals of qualified people.
Sure.
You know, so I learned how to do it. And, you know, most employers want to do the right thing. I think prior to 73, they weren't sure what the right thing was.
Right. But that's true, yeah.
After 73, still was hard to get people jobs because you had that psychological barriers that employers
right.
have. A lot of people think if you're blind, you may as well be dead. How can you hold a job?
And, yeah, I know.
But,
yeah.
I did. If my philosophy at the time was face to face, I would want a face to face meeting with the employer. I'd walk in, and probably halfway through my interview with the employer, I would mention that I was legally blind, and they could see that
you were able to function.
And that blindness was on a continuum of, you know, being legally blind, having some low vision to total blindness.
Sure.
So,
you said 8 years in placement and in job working with people to find employment for people who came to the Lighthouse. What happened after the 8 years?
You know, one of the things I did when I started working at the Lighthouse, I wanted to do everything.
Right.
So, not just placement. So whenever there was the Lighthouse was shorthanded somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, I would try to step in, like in the recreation program. If, you know, we had a program going, I'd step in if they needed an extra hand. Or when I would go out and talk with employers, because one of the things the Lighthouse has is a manufacturing program.
Right. Was that in existence at the time?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
When I started, that was probably the 90% of what the Lighthouse did. We had an industries program mm-hmm. that employed about 200 people who are blind and manufacturing products.
Right.
And so if I was out talking to an employer, I would throw that in too. Do you have any contracts that we could bid on? I would bring in contracts for the shop as well as making placements outside. So I always wanted to sort of
do it all,
know everything.
It all. Yeah.
And because, you know, as openings occur above,
right,
they'll look for someone who knows something about that.
Absolutely.
And maybe has some experience there. So I always enjoyed trying to learn everything.
You know, and that's so true not only for people with a disability, but it's also true for anybody in the general public. If you want to move up, the more you know about the company you're working with or the profession that you're in, the better your chances are of making that move up in that. And then, I mean, it just holds through. So you, after the employment services, what was the next, your next hurdle?
Well, you know, the shop was, we had some major contracts. One of which was with Western Electric, which basically went out of business.
Yeah.
They changed their name, Lucent Technologies and other things, AT&T, whatever.
Right.
But you know, one of the major products we had was automated out of existence. So the shop experienced a shortage of work.
Right.
So I was looking for contracts, and eventually they just, you know, I was bringing in some contracts to compensate for the loss of a product that mm-hmm. was automated out of existence, and I was offered the job of running the shop.
Okay, all
so,
right.
So I took it.
They figured, what the hell? This guy goes out and gets the work. We might as well put him in charge of the shop. Yeah.
So then but they never took placement away from me. You know, I ran the shop and was in charge of placement too. That
Jim,
sort of followed me through my whole career.
You're good at this. But, you know, we still want to keep you in placement, too. Yeah, that's it.
That's one thing I'd have to say about Chicago Lighthouse. They always recognized, right from the day I started, the importance of competitive job placements.
Sure.
Move a person in to our program, give them some experience, let them gain some confidence and some skills, and then what you want to do is move them into a competitive job. It always had, we had a great philosophy, still have that philosophy here.
But after the running the shop and doing the placement, what else did you do before
I got the opportunity for the shop from Milt Samuelson, who became executive director in the late 70s.
Okay.
And then he was second in command, but as he moved up, I moved up. So,
right.
You know, we worked well together.
Right.
You know, he would give me assignments, and I tried to pull them off as best as I could. So I ran eventually at one time or another every single program at the Lighthouse, either collectively or individually.
And right.
Eventually became director of professional services and then assistant executive director. Then executive director and president of the
And what year was that?
Executive director probably 95 and president a few years after that.
Now we're at 1995 and you've taken on the position of executive director at the Lighthouse. What was your reaction? How did you feel? Were you scared?
I was probably surprised that I got an opportunity to be.
Do that? Yeah.
Yeah, because if you look back at, in 1995, there were very few people who were blind running not-for-profits in America at that time. So, again, when I think about Chicago Lighthouse and its own attitude and, you know, it just wasn't afraid to, put on in the head position someone who was blind.
You were comfortable. They were comfortable with you, and you were comfortable because you knew what the departments were all about and knew what the organization was all about and where it was heading.
You know, I knew blindness.
Yeah.
And I wrote most of our state and federal grants.
Sure.
And managed those. But I'll never forget when I interviewing for executive director, I was asked, what are your weaknesses?
Yeah.
You know, I think my weakness was fundraising.
Okay.
So,
welcome to the club. Oh, God, do I know that feeling well, you know, yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things that I felt the agency had to have was someone in a management level, management team level
sure.
position in fundraising. A professional.
Right.
And we moved to that, and I'll tell you, I learned a lot.
That's the important thing that you learn when to strengthen that weakness is to learn. You know, we talked about the professional career, and we're going to get back to talk more about that because you held the position of executive director until 2008.
2009.
2009, and you saw a lot of changes made. But let's talk a little bit about Jim and Barb Kestelud, because there was a time in the life when there was a very special lady in your life, and she stuck with you through all these years, right?
Yeah, we got married 46 years.
Congratulations. Congratulations. God bless that woman. She's put up with you for 46
years.
Oh, yeah. But you've had a family. You've had everything that anyone could want and hope for. As far as a good personal life, I mean, I've talked to you off the air, and I know very much how close you are with your family and how much you value the time that you spend with them and everything. And you've had a job over the years where you've had to be away from them for a time because of the responsibilities of the job and everything. And I think you feel it's important to have somebody who's working with you as part of your team, meaning your wife Barb, that was there for you to help you out.
I'm so glad you brought that up because, I have met Barb. We were just kids, basically. She was senior in high school. I was in my first year of college.
Yeah.
And we have three kids. One's an attorney for Ford Motor Company. One operates in, has a brewery in Iowa.
No kidding.
And the other is a vice president of a company in Des Moines.
You got to be very proud.
And I think the most important ingredient in rehabilitation is love.
Mm-hmm.
If you have someone losing sight, I mean, how can you adjust to the loss of sight if you're not loved?
Right.
So I think, I think a lot of times parents get bad raps. They're doing this wrong or that wrong.
Sure.
But in general, the most important ingredient in rehabilitation is being accepted, being loved, being understood.
Mm-hmm.
Having some motivation.
Sure.
Love is what does that, I think. So it's an important thing.
And I have to tell everybody it still exists because we had the installation of officers for the Central Lions Club earlier this month. And Jim and Barb sat with me at the table along with our district governor, Dave Hansen. And we had just a great time. It was terrific, and you could see that the relationship has done everything and has grown over the years. Just the relaxedness between the two of you. I mean, it was just amazing. It's really good. It's an example for a lot of people to be able to see what a great relationship that you guys have had. Now, you left the Lighthouse in 2009. You retired at that point. And you took on a bigger responsibility, a bigger role, I think, when you got involved with the U.S. Ability One Commission. Tell us a little bit about that. Were you surprised when you were asked to become part of that commission?
I was surprised because the commission has 15 members appointed by the President of the United States. The commission was created in 1938 by an act of Congress. And the commission is made up of 15 members, as I said, appointed by the president. 11 members are executives in the federal government, and 4 are private citizens that the president also appoints. And the there's probably a lot of people who would like to have that position. So from that standpoint, I consider myself very fortunate. I was appointed by President Obama in 2010. I'm currently the vice chairman of the U.S. Ability One Commission.
Are you really? Congratulations. That's great.
The commission has the power through the act of Congress and through its members casting votes to issue production and service contracts to not-for-profits that employ people who are blind or employ people with disabilities. So we issue, we do about $3 billion in sales a year.
Wow.
And all of the production is done by not-for-profits across America, both serving people with general disabilities and people who are blind.
Do we see, Jim, because of the industry's program that the Chicago Lighthouse has, I'm sure there's other organizations, social service agencies and not-for-profits that, that have industries programs as well, not only for visually impaired, but I'm talking for developmentally disabled, for hearing impaired, for other types of physical disabilities and that. Do we find that with the economy having come off of a very deep recession that it's more difficult to have the get the work for the organizations that are performing the services and the products?
Yeah, that's also a very good question. There are actually 596 not-for-profit agencies across America that have contracts through the U.S. Ability One Commission, and again, it's $3 billion in sales.
Sure.
And this year, of course, Congress implemented sequestration.
Right.
Which is involves austerity, cutbacks in spending, cutbacks in travel, cutbacks in all kinds of things to deal with the federal deficit. So because of that, a lot of the agencies that receive Ability One contracts have had their contracts reduced and in some cases eliminated. So it's put a burden on a lot of the not-for-profits who depend on federal contracts to employ people who are blind and employ people with disabilities. There are some agencies that have had a severe experience in cutbacks and layoffs because of federal contracts downsizing, or just the federal government's austerity in purchasing products that they have contracts for. It's not unusual to see an agency that might have had to lay off 30, 40, 50 people because the products and services aren't in demand because of sequestration itself. So it puts a new onus on the Ability One Commission and on not-for-profits to come up with ideas for contracts and maybe even to look to the private sector for contracts to supplement their federal work. Cool. One of the contracts Chicago Lighthouse has through the U.S. Ability One Commission is the manufacture and supply of clocks to the federal government. So that's through the U.S. Ability One Commission. So Chicago Lighthouse supplies all federal agencies, both civilian and military, with clocks, employs maybe 15, 20 people here at the Lighthouse. So most agencies that supply products or supply services have had cutbacks because of sequestration.
You know, it's interesting. It sounds like a lot of agencies need the young Jim Kestelute, who not only went out looking for people, for jobs for people, but to bring back contracts to work in their particular shops and services areas and that. You're on the committee. How long does your term last for the commission?
I was appointed July of 2010 through December of 2014.
Okay.
But I'd be eligible for a reappointment.
At that point?
Yes.
Do you?
It's a five-year appointment.
What do you look for as your future once you get done? Let's say you do get appointed for another term. Are you going to retire or are you going to keep going?
You know, it's pretty hard to leave the lighthouse. You know, I was, you know, working here since January of 69.
Right.
But my first contact with the lighthouse was when I was 13.
Yes.
1958.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm into, 55, 60 years contact with the lighthouse. So, you know, the place gets in your blood.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
And I have great respect for Janet Slick, who's the current president mm-hmm. of the Chicago Lighthouse. Very innovative thinking,
mm-hmm.
Very into creating jobs for people who are blind. You know, I'd like to hang around and still do what I can.
Sure.
On the board here at Chicago Lighthouse.
Through Dr. Slick, I mean, we see the how things have adapted to the 21st century with the call centers now, getting contracts to do more of that type of work for employment opportunities for people with disabilities, not only visually impaired, but people with disabilities in general. So
one of the U.S. Ability One Commission contracts that was issued to the Chicago Lighthouse was a U.S. Army contract closing out
mm-hmm.
U.S. Army contracts. So we probably, Chicago Lighthouse probably has 10 to 15 people who are blind working at the Rock Island Arsenal,
mm-hmm.
one of our sites right there on the military base, and here at the Chicago Lighthouse where we employ people who are blind as contract closeout officers. They're on Lighthouse payroll,
sure,
but they close out contracts just like contract officers do for the federal government in the same pay. Roughly the same, well, not roughly, it is the same
yeah.
pay as if you were a contract officer, closeout officer for federal government. So so some very innovative contracts that Janet's brought in.
So we're not looking for Jim Kestelow to retire anytime soon, to stay active, to stay involved, and to keep bringing along the yeah. knowledge that you've gained over the years, like you said, in many different areas, and
yeah.
you're doing that now with the outside, with the U.S. Ability One Commission, with your membership on the board over at the American Foundation of the Blind. We didn't even touch on that, but we're running a little bit out of time.
Well, the American Foundation for the Blind, that's really Helen Keller's organization. Helen Keller worked for American Foundation for the Blind for over 40 years.
Sure.
And she left her archives to the American Foundation for the Blind. I see them as an agency that helps really set national policy
mm-hmm.
for issues related to blindness.
Well, that's good. I'm glad. And they couldn't ask for a better guy. Because if you don't know the answer, you'll know where to go get it. That's for doggone sure. Hey, thanks for taking time joining us early on this Saturday morning to talk a little bit about you. And as we were talking about before we got on the air, you enjoy talking about the experiences because you've had a lifetime like I did, where you it may have worked, but it didn't feel like it because you've enjoyed what you did. You've had the ability to do all your life.
Well, thanks for having me, Bill.
Thanks for being part of the Lighthouse, and thanks for joining us on our program this morning. Our show is The Beacon, Tom's Corner.
It's Tom's Corner. And Tom, you've been a busy man. Good morning, by the way.
Brian Hawkins, how are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm doing great. And it seems like we're going to start off with the topic of Northwestern. And you were there this past week talking to medical students.
Yes, I was. It's been really interesting. We've been invited the last 3 years to come and address the second year medical students. And so it's a full auditorium. They're all in their white coats. There's about 300 of them, so
it's pretty intimidating.
It really is, but I think they like the way my style, because I tell a lot of personal stories and living with my story of losing my vision at 19 years old and some of the things that I went through. And so what's really great, I think, about it is that, of course, the medical students have a lot to learn when it comes to the diagnosing and treating and pharmaceuticals, but this is a part of what they call their health and society sort of course on the real world and how it affects people and how it affects our society in general. And in fact, there was a professor there of ophthalmology who spoke before me who talked about that very fact, and I thought it was just very interesting to think about, you know, the way it affects the individual. And there's many ways that they're looking at and statistically how it affects a person and how they, if they're blind or visually impaired, how it may affect how they live or how they eat to get to the store and have the right nutrition or how they may or may not be able to take their pharmaceuticals or their pills in the right order. And they had stories of a fellow who almost died just because he had cataracts and couldn't take his medication properly anymore. And then he talked about the family members and the caretakers, and their whole life starts to change and reacting to the blind person, the spouse or whatever, and then other family members that have to come in and be a caretaker, and how it starts to affect their life. And so it broadens the story and it broadens the picture quite a bit. And if somebody, for instance, can no longer live in their own home alone and so forth, and having to give up their home and move into a nursing facility or rehabilitation facility, the costs associated with those things have been into the millions and millions now of vision loss. So it was a very unique time, and I really enjoyed, you know, listening, and then for me, being able to share with the students just my own story, as well as the technology that's out there that we talk about, of course, on this show all the time. Mm-hmm. Speaking of Northwestern,
yes,
I just thought I would mention that we do actually have a low vision clinic doctor right there at Northwestern. And some people, I haven't mentioned that before. I just thought I should mention that. Because if you're downtown or if you're a patient already at Northwestern, you can be seen in the low vision clinic. That's right there, behind the Apple store there on Michigan Avenue.
Oh, okay.
Is their facility. And so to make an appointment, you would call our regular number, which is 312-997-3686 for an appointment there. And I thought I would highlight that today. By the way, that same number can make you an appointment at some of our other clinics. So we do have a clinic in Flossmoor, also in the south.
Right.
And that's been very popular. And then recently, I think I've mentioned that we've been going to Northwest Indiana now. We've hired a doctor who is there to do low vision evaluations twice a month. When she is there to see patients, Eric from our technology team is also there the same day. And so in between patients, he'll have time to meet with you if you want to just sit and talk with Eric and you live in that area, or you want to learn about a smartphone or a tablet. You can actually make an appointment with Eric through our assistive technology center. Sandra makes all those appointments. Mm-hmm. So Sandra is 312-997-3677. No, 997-3677. And say that you want to meet with Eric when he goes to Indiana. And that's been really good because we've had lots of people who said that they wanted to learn more about the iPad. And so last time Eric was there, he met with three patients with low vision. And then Roosevelt, who's our intern, who's totally blind, he also, who lives in Crown Point, Roosevelt went there that same day and met with three people who were totally blind. Mm-hmm. And they all did iPad stuff, which was kind of like really cool.
It was. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So, but these are things that we're involved in meeting with people who are interested in learning more about technology for the blind or visually impaired. Coming in our retail store, some people just call the day before and make a time to come in. Here, both here at 1850 West Roosevelt and in our Glenview location.
Right.
And I think I mentioned a few weeks ago that we have Ann Kelly is a new technology person in Glenview now. She's there Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday, all day. So if you'd like to talk with Ann, you can certainly call there. Let me give you that number. It's 847-510-6200. So 847-510-6200. So if you just want to sit and talk with her or see what's available now, mm-hmm. our Glenview location is, we're all excited about that.
So she's there for that.
She is. She
now, is. You mentioned earlier that there was a company that is doing something with traffic signals, new traffic signals.
Oh, that's right. You know, many companies do call us and they hear about some of the things that we're doing. And so I thought this was kind of interesting to, I'll have more information because we did invite them to come and demonstrate. Mm-hmm. But they're interested in, you know, audible signals for the blind pedestrians at intersections at key points around the city. And one of the new things that they've developed, this new company, is Bluetooth-enabled traffic signals, so that, for instance, if you came up to the corner and you had their free app on your smartphone, mm-hmm. you could press the button on your phone instead of having to find it on the pole, which would be one easy way to press the button. The app might tell you you have 18 seconds before the light starts to turn green, or anything that would interact with that intersection, and so that's kind of a new thing that being able to have a Bluetooth enabled intersection, you know, for persons who are low vision or blind,
right?
And being able to find out more. So I thought that was really interesting, and we're going to look into that. And of course, it's hard to get the city to spend more money on things like this.
Right, yeah, right? I bet it is.
So our job, of course, is to advocate for the blind and make sure that we can let the world know that these things are out there, mm-hmm. and the world is changing, and let's get it going for people with disabilities.
Yeah, we've got to keep up with the changes.
Yeah.
Now, in addition to all that, you are also on the road. You've got, what, three more shows?
We have this month three shows. We are very busy. We want to say hello to everyone in Frankfort last week. We had a really good turnout for Frankfort Township. So we're going to do Southside one more time Thursday, September 8th. And that's going to be at the Private Bank location. That's 7103 West 111th Street in Worth, Illinois.
Okay.
It's called their Founders Square location. And that's from 10 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. That's free. It's open to the public. Come and see many independent living aides and technology aides and meet our staff and find out what's out there to help you if you know somebody with vision loss. Thursday, September 15th, we are going to be in the northwest suburbs in Arlington Heights at the Wheeling Township offices, which is a nice building. It's 1616 North Arlington Heights Road, Wheeling Township, and there again from 10 to 3. That location also actually has a low vision support group that meets monthly, so they're very active there. In the people who go there and learn and support each other in learning to live with vision loss. Mm-hmm. But we will be there with all of our products there on September 15th. And then on Thursday, the 22nd, we are going to be at our Chicago Lighthouse North location in Glenview for the day from 10 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. That's 222 Waukegan Road in Glenview. So lots of Thursdays, and we're going to be busy.
Yeah, that's September. Those are the places to be for road shows. Well, thanks a lot, Tom. That's great information. He's Tom Persky. I'm Brian Hawkins. This is The Beacon.
Every day, PACE is helping more and more people with disabilities take control of their day.
My friends change plans a lot, which was tough because my rides had to be booked a day before. One day, I figured out how easy it was to put my wheelchair onto regular PACE buses. Since then, I haven't missed out on any pickup games. Yesterday, I had 10 rebounds.
Freedom means being able to go wherever I want, when I want. Before, things like missing an ingredient for a recipe or other unexpected errands were a real pain to figure out. Once I learned my service dog Nola was welcome aboard PACE Fix routes, we've been riding ever since.
Hi, I'm Bridget Brown. If you're anything like me, it drives you nuts when you feel like you're missing out on things. Now I make plans in the middle of the day without even thinking twice about it, thanks to the PACE Bus.
When you're ready to take control of your day, visit PACEBus.com or call 847-364-PACE. PACE, connecting communities.
Patty, I boldly went to socialsecurity.gov, and it's out of this world.
Socialsecurity.gov is a website for everybody.
Even teenagers?
Absolutely. Young people can help their grandparents with retiring online or getting extra help with their Medicare prescription drug costs.
Everyone should go to socialsecurity.gov.
That's going to do it for our Beacon program this week. We hope you've enjoyed our profile look at Mr. Jim Kestelute, who is the former president, chief executive officer at the Chicago Lighthouse. We will be back next Saturday, and Lainey will be with us. In the meantime, have yourself a great week. Thanks to Dr. Janet Slick, our executive director at the Chicago Lighthouse, for making all of this possible. Music in the background is by Mr. Mike Henson. He wrote, produced, and performed it, available at CDBaby.com. And of course, Brian Hawkins not only did a great job in Tom's Corner, but all the fantastic work engineering our program and making it sound as good as he does every week. Stick around. The Mighty House People are coming up next. We've got a couple of words for you, then the news, and we'll see you back here next Saturday morning at 7 o'clock, right here on Chicago's Progressive Talk.